Well, we need to build communities of practice and solid relationships to support each other, getting through the short-term hurt of shifting to genuinely sustainable communities and paradigms, and develop cultural practices of connection that we can do collaboratively and with joy.
Hello and welcome to One Bite, a podcast exploring the Australian food system. I'm your host, Xavier Callio, a food researcher and sustainability student at the University of Sydney. This series focuses on the impacts of COVID-19 and how we build back better. We will meet Australians working from farm to fork and beyond, gaining diverse perspectives on our food system and how we can shift to more sustainable, resilient and fair food. So grab your knife, fork and spoon and join me as we digest the Australian foodscape, one bite at a time. Hello and welcome to One Bite. Xavier here. Today I'll be speaking with author and academic Tyson Yunkaporta. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the lands that I'm on, and pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. Tyson Yunkaporta is an academic, an arts critic and a researcher who belongs to the Apalache clan in far north Queensland. He carves traditional tools and weapons and also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne. So welcome to One Bite, Tyson. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, good to be here, Zoe.
What are you really enjoying eating right now?
I've just shifted back to cutting out the starch again. Starch is a killer, eh? Yeah, it's just whenever I can afford to do that, I'll do it. But, you know, starch is cheap. Pretty much most of this year I've been living on starch and really feeling it. So in the last couple of weeks I've gone back on, you know, just real food for a bit. And I'll see how long I can afford that. And then it'll be back to, you know, noodles and rice and cans of food again. Yeah.
So just for our listeners, your book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, bent my brain in the most amazing way. Could you just explain the premise of the book?
Yeah, it's basically applying an Indigenous lens to the complex problems of the world. I don't know, so it's a kind of reversal on the usual thing. It's almost reverse anthropology. So I think people are buying the book expecting to see all this Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous wisdom, but yeah, the content of the culture is not the point. It's the processes and methods of inquiry and ways of thinking and, you know, what the world looks like and what problems look like if you apply those, you know, almost applying Indigenous as a verb, I guess. Yeah, just doing some thought experiments and seeing what falls out of that, but kind of in a fun way.
Yeah.
And just, you know, a provocation. Not provocative, but just a series of provocations to, you know, send people's minds off in other directions.
Yep.
I mean, their minds don't have to come this way. It doesn't demand that. But it kind of, you can't read that book without bringing your own stories into the circle, you know? So half the book is you. And I think most people could benefit from a bit of an awareness of the narratives that they're carrying around. Because, you know, everything's story. Most people don't realize that they're even in a culture. Because it's like a fish doesn't know they're in water. It's the same way. To become aware of that water around you is a very powerful thing. Particularly if you're swimming in bad water, you can then at least figure out a way to move to some better stuff.
Yeah, and something that you say in there which really kind of hit home is it's not about helping people learn about Aboriginal knowledge, but about remaking your own and reconnecting with that lost collective memory, which I think is really powerful.
Yeah, not everybody gets that. I think some people think of it as an invitation to sort of just come in and take things, you know. But that's that story, that bad story, the sort of project of Western civilization, which is to, you know, go forth and take stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I guess the desire coming out of the Enlightenment is to get bits and pieces of knowledge and technology from around the world and sort of try and unify them together into one story, one grand narrative to rule them all. It's a hegemonic thing, you know. And it is really hard to escape that narrative if you're in it.
Yeah, hegemony is just like the dominant kind of cultural or influence in the society. So in terms of looking at food systems and some of the sustainability issues around our food systems, How could we take a different perspective, and how would you take an Indigenous perspective on looking at some of these things?
Well, most people who are doing any thinking in that field at all, any kind of real thinking, are arriving at the same conclusion of, you know, local and regional has to be the way things are going to go with our food supply. Otherwise, everything and everyone's going to die. And I think the massive disruptions to the supply chains and stuff like that with COVID is getting people to focus on that a little bit more. I guess from an Indigenous perspective, there's just some additional layers to that idea of regionality. And I think a lot of people are coming into a more Indigenous feeling about that. You know, when they start to look at not the boundaries of their shire, sort of political boundaries, they're sort of looking more at their bioregion. And when you start to come into that idea of a bioregion, then you're beginning to approximate the boundaries of traditional custodians. Yeah, and starting to come more into a custodial role yourself. And I guess it's that spirit and knowledge and pedagogy and everything else, the patterns that are in the land, and most importantly, the capital L, law, the law of the land that you find in each bioregion. You know, that it's got, there's a spirit of place there, and that will direct you to what you can and can't do, and how you can become embedded within that landscape, and then how you can act as a custodian for it, and work all of those lovely edges within that landscape to find your sustenance, to find your meaning, everything else. If food is more than just finding vitamins to nourish you, this machine of your body, there's all different kinds of nourishment that comes from your landscape that you miss out on if you're just, you know, mass importing food as resources that have been extracted through the depletion of soil and water, etc.
Absolutely. And I think an interesting thing that you touch on in the book is around the different paradigms of scarcity and abundance in terms of our thinking, and particularly we can see that around food.
Yeah, well, that's just about an artificial economic system that's been imposed. You know, there was an economic model that was developed quite recently, you know, a few decades back, that sort of, it needs to create artificial scarcity in order for anything to have value, more particularly price. You know, in order to price something, you need two things. It needs limitability and it needs excludability. In order for anything really to have a price within this kind of magical thinking economy that we've been forced to adopt. So limitability in terms of, you know, there needs to be only a kind of a limited amount of those things, and the resource must be finite in some way. It needs to be made to be finite. There needs to be this undercurrent of panic, this weird combination of confidence and panic in order for it to work. I mean, it's such a curse. It's just ridiculous. So they have to create artificial scarcity from that point of view, but then also excludability. You need to be able to exclude an ever-increasing amount of the population from access to those resources so that people will struggle for them and will conform in order to access them, you know, and will exclude others so that everybody has that sword hanging over their head constantly of, oh my God, I don't want to end up like those fellas. So we identify different groups to marginalize and to deny access. That's how scarcity is created. So, you know, I mean, everybody talks about inequality like it's a problem within ourselves, that it's a natural sort of human xenophobic thing, and that it's human beings creating these inequalities. But it's not. It's just a really stupid economic system that can only function with inequality at its center.
And in the book, you talk about literacy programs in Indigenous communities, and you give an example of the Cuban model that's kind of embedded in Indigenous knowledge, and the way that they're addressing inequality as a social problem as opposed to an individual problem.
I mean, that's a direct assault on the economic model completely, and it's viewed as such. You know, so while a number of communities, Indigenous communities in Australia, have taken on that Cuban literacy program, you know, because it's about an entire community approach, and about creating literate cultures, you know, within the community, like an actual tide, rising tide that lifts all boats, you know, which this current economic system claims to do, but really doesn't, because the trickle down just don't work. Yeah, so that's been viewed quite unfavorably, and it has not been taken up, although it's had quite a few successes in trials in different communities, such as Wilcannia in far western New South Wales. Wilcannia's like the Aurukun of New South Wales. It's a very remote and marginalized community with a lot of problems. So these individualized literacy programs that are around skills acquisition, you know, you can do it, you can be anything, you can gain this skill and leave and become a real human being kind of thing. And that's all about transformation of capital, etc., to kind of enter the game theoretical nightmare of this current economy, which is in its death throes anyway, so, you know.
We can only hope. And I raise that literacy program because we can kind of relate that back to food, and we can relate that back to the way we kind of tell people what they should eat, that they should be healthy, the choices they should be making on a personal level without addressing the actual structural issues underneath that. And there's a report about resilience and innovation in Indigenous communities. Yeah. And it actually says, this report challenges the notion that resilience and innovation can be enabled at the individual and community scale whilst restrictive regulations are in place.
Yeah, and those it's interesting, you know, like the dominant culture is all about sort of deregulation, but what they really mean by that is deregulation for very large corporate entities, and then excessive regulation for everyone else. The structure of it really is a food pyramid. It's a food pyramid economically, not just nutritionally. You know, as I said at the start, you know, we don't have a lot of options beyond starch to keep us going at a lot of different levels. And, you know, it's always really amusing to see in remote communities where the where there's really a limited range of food in the local store, and it costs up to five times as much as what it would cost in the city. It is really funny to see where the money goes for that. And the money goes into trying to educate us to make better choices about our food. You know, so you've got these deadly choices posters on the wall that are really, well, there are really only deadly choices, like literally deadly choices available. And all you see on those posters, the better sort of settler menus that we don't actually have access to. And they're just telling us, well, come on, you've just got to make better choices individually, and then you'll be fine. You won't have diabetes. It's, oh, well, thanks for that. That's lovely. They also spend a lot of money. So every year you'll see a big audit happening where that particular problem that I just addressed, there's an inquiry into that. And, you know, someone comes into the community for a month and collects a lot of data on that problem and then goes away. So there's just millions and millions spent in each community. I mean, they could just take a fraction of that and subsidize the food or the transport for the food. They could take an even smaller fraction of that and actually set up, you know, local and regional agribusinesses that are run by the community. It would cost less and would have significant returns in a very short time, save billions of dollars. That's not what they do. Every now and then they'll throw out one of those little programs. Oh, we're going to do a greenhouse in the community. It'll be the community garden. And it's always designed to fail, and it always just falls apart. And you go in and you see this terrible dead soil with a few straggly pawpaws growing out or something. And it's just, oh, okay, lovely. I think those things are really just put there to sort of prove to everyone, look, you can't grow your own stuff. It doesn't work. You're going to have to submit to this. And also you've got to blame yourself at the same time.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I did some work with some nutritionists a while ago, really well-meaning, lovely people. And, you know, they were doing, you know, an Indigenous project, and they were looking at addressing diabetes, you know, case by case, because that's how you do it, individual by individual, and just trying to educate, you know, some poor old auntie who's 1,000 miles away from home in the city just trying to scrape by, and there and she just does not have enough on her pension to get by, and she's got cousins and kids and nephews and nieces and grandkids coming in and bloody picking her fridge clean every day anyway, and she actually has to feed like 12 people on that pension. And they're coming in there and they're giving her recipes and a menu, and they're saying, oh, you know, your studies have shown that an Indigenous diet, you know, is actually really healthy. So then they just try and imagine what an Indigenous diet is. And so they imagine that that means eating native foods, like, you know, Australian natives. You know, it doesn't matter if you're in a region where macadamia nuts doesn't grow, we're going to put macadamia nuts on your menu. It doesn't matter that it's like, you know, $1 million a kilo for these macadamia nuts that we're going to put on your daily meal plan. Anyway, I call that the Murray Antoinette syndrome. Not Marie, but Murray. So the Murray Antoinette syndrome is like, you know, let them eat lemon myrtle cake.
Yes.
Because that was on this menu, you know, that she was going to make herself a nice little lemon myrtle cake, and that was going to fix her diabetes. And, you know, she's got to, you know, be able to afford a bit of barramundi for breakfast. Like, wouldn't we all like to have a bit of barramundi for breakfast? That'd be awesome. But she'd have to be on 150K a year to afford the menu that they made for her. Yeah. But the reality is, you know, it's going to be tinned bully beef. It's going to be chicken wings. It's going to be potatoes. It's going to be, you know, rice, lots and lots of rice. Keane's curry powder and, you know, some frozen veggies. That's what her diet is going to be. All right. So, you know, I challenged them. Okay, well, you need to be able to create a menu for her that's going to be like $20 a day and that she's going to be able to feed at least half a dozen people with, because that's the reality, because everybody else's kids are coming to her house for a feed. So, yeah, see how you can work that out. I tell you what would be even better is that all the funding that you have to create these little fantasy menus, how about you take some of that and just put it in her bank account? The gap will close like a motherfucker. Yeah.
yeah. But that's not how people think about these things. And, no. You know, I think in the book you really describe an Indigenous kind of culinary logic. And, you know, I love this kind of line, emu fillet medallions with a kwandong glaze is not Aboriginal cooking.
Yeah.
It's about a holistic method grounded in regional and seasonal knowledge. Mm.
Yeah, I got in a lot of trouble for that.
Really?
Yeah, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, Indigenous businesses that operate on that, because basically, you know, our only capital as Indigenous people is the white gaze. And so we have to pretty much just feed that gaze what it wants to see. So rightly so, there are a lot of people going, shut the fuck up, Tyson. We know that, but don't tell them that. That's the only thing that we're surviving on right now. You know, so fair enough.
Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, magpie, goose, carpaccio it is. Yeah. But the reality of it is that, you know, Indigenous culinary logic is about using what's seasonal, you know, because animal fats are only good in the right season. Sweet potatoes, yams, these things are only good when the vine dies off in the cold time. That's when you're supposed to have that. Chicken is also only good in the cold time, you know, because they're not funneling all their energies into reproductive stuff. Everybody knows, I don't care what culture you're from, the chicken is good in winter. You have chicken soup when you got a cold. Everyone knows that. And when do you get a cold? At that time. And that's when chicken is medicinal. Your spring chicken got no medicine in it at all. You know, so the idea is eating things in season, but then there's also a communal ethic that you're not just making food for yourself. You're always making food for a set of relationships, and that's where the food sits. And there's also, you know, affordability is a, you know, you get what's affordable as well, and you do the best that you can. Also, slow cooking, even what most people would consider to be overcooking. You know, you do that and you keep the juice. You don't drain the juice off. That's the juice is good.
The juice is good.
Yeah.
So it's really about time, place, seasonality,
yep,
balance and variety.
Yeah.
Sort of the key messages that I kind of gleaned from that chapter.
Yeah.
And I think that those things can be really easily kind of transferred to anybody's diet.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
But then I guess at the growing food side as well, it's about diversity in your crop, you know, indigenous land care kind of stuff. You know, you're keeping diversity in that crop and you're growing the right things in the right place and harvesting in the right season. There's also what you leave behind. There's a lot of practices that a lot of people would consider to be wasteful. A lot of people would imagine that we're, you know, leaving most of the food behind. But a lot of times, you know, traditionally we'll over-harvest a lot of things and we'll leave a lot of what would be regarded as litter. So it's that abundance mentality. You know, half the food when you've eaten, you just leave it there on the ground. But that's not waste. You know, the idea is that your patterns of how you eat and where you eat on the landscape, that's moving things around, you know, and it's transferring energy. And it's, you know, for example, if you bring a big mob of shellfish up from the beach up onto the ridge, you know, that's a ridge where the trees have come to depend on, you know, what you're bringing up from the ocean. And, you know, you're bringing stuff up there that's needed and that wouldn't get up there in any other way. So the waste that you leave behind from your own body, but also from your abundant food that you are littering around the place, that's also needed there. And there's that sense that there's your ancestors and the spirits of the place are also partaking of that food. So it's, you know, nothing is wasted in that way. Yeah, there's a lot of ideas in there.
I don't know if you've read Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer.
I haven't, but I've heard so much about it. It's on my list of things to read, yeah.
It's a wonderful book, and she talks about the concept of the honourable harvest.
Right.
And, you know, taking only what you need and using everything, and that idea of there is abundance and that things can be left to be part of the natural system and part of the natural cycle again.
Yeah. And look, there's ethics and things built into different bioregions, you know, from the story of that place, and it's in the law there. So you might understand that digging a hole to harvest root vegetables, that if you left that uncovered when you walked away, you know, that place is your mother's country, and so that would make her sick.
Mm.
You know, it would make her belly sick to leave that exposed, you know, earth there, so you need to cover it back up.
Yeah, and I think that embeddedness in culture, that food is more than just something that you eat sort of mindlessly to kind of calories to get through the day. It's something that is thought about and respected, and, you know, that food comes from the soil and it comes from the land, and
yeah,
it is making you literally.
Well, look, any biological imperative that you have that's related to the land, one of the biggest ones is eating. You know, that puts you in relation to the land and it shows you what you need to do. And it also is your biggest source of meaning making and sense making. So your meaning making and your sense making come out of that relation, out of that dynamic relation with the landscape as well, you know? Yeah, that's really important because that's a sentient landscape. And that landscape is communicating with you as an organism that is patterned on that landscape and embedded in that landscape. And, you know, when you start to fit in with that ecosystem, then your habits of harvesting and eating food are part of a regenerative process within that dynamic system. One example I've used before is that, you know, in order to access in a certain place that really fat medicinal catfish in the right season, you need to burn the grass in order to get rid of the mosquitoes so that you can actually catch that without getting eaten alive, you know. And that process is part of that, you know, and the things you leave behind from the catfish and the other things that you do in that place, they all contribute, you know, to the regeneration of everything in land and water in that place. And you're part of that. And basically, that's what's behind that often shallow sentiment of if you look after the land will look after you. Because that sentiment is still coming from a sense of being separate from landscape. But if you're embedded within it, then it doesn't really work the same way. You know, your habits of looking after yourself are so deeply embedded with looking after country that there's really no way to separate yourself from the land in any meaningful way. And your economic systems and your governance systems are patterned on that same relation. And so they're not separate in a stack or anything else. They're actually embedded in the landscape as well and flowing from the landscape. And that's what I find exciting about a lot of the millennial permaculture communities, you know, coming up, is that they're actually sensing that and working with it. And they're in that communication with a sentient landscape. That's quite exciting.
Yeah. And in kind of being embedded in the landscape, and you talk about fostering emergence and a way to be a kind of sustainability agent as a way of kind of shifting our thinking, not what we think, but how we think.
Yeah, well, that's all about fostering the conditions for emergence. Emergence is how change happens sustainably within a system and how problems are solved by the system. And I mean, for that, you need to be able to trust that a system, that a natural system, is sentient and self-organizing, you know, and that you're a part of that. You're not standing outside of the system, observing it and then tweaking it or making changes or doing interventions. You're actually in that system and you're part of a system that is observing itself and that is managing itself. And so you have to come into the patterns of that system. You know, and so, you know, in order to do that, you know, there is a good metaphor that I use that's from, you know, complexity theory. You know, it's almost using computer language, looking at the operating protocols of an individual node, you know, within a complex adaptive system, which is sustainable and self-sustaining. And so each node within that system has a few operating protocols. And yeah, the four of those that I'm really interested in, because I think the fewer the better. I tell you, these millennials, like I always say, they love rules. They love lots and lots of rules governing every single interaction and possible behavior you could have. But that doesn't work. That's a tinkered system. You're better off just having people just free ranging through the system with a few very basic operating protocols. Yeah, so I look at the four of those, which are really good and all-encompassing and very generative. So that's diversity, interaction, connection, and adaptation. Once you start expanding on those a bit, you get a bit of a pattern for, you know, how you might be in the world, even in an unhealthy system, how you might start operating like that and how generative that might be. With the idea of diversity, that's about not just interacting with a lot of agents who are quite different from you, you know, culturally or biologically or et cetera. So, you know, humans and non-humans, lots of different kinds of humans and different genders and everything else. It's not just that. In fact, it's a lot more than that. Like primarily, it's about making sure that you're maintaining your difference and your uniqueness from the agents around you who are most similar to you. You know, because if you end up with a big bunch of nodes who are all very, very similar, then you end up with stagnation. You end up with entropy. You know, so you have to maintain your individual difference. And I guess if you were just following that one, you'd end up with rampant individualism.
Well, that doesn't sound familiar at all.
Weirdly, from... It's funny, you know, even the kind of tokenistic diversity models that we have that are kind of trying to honor and empower different group identities, they still seem to be resulting in rampant individualism, you know. So I guess the next couple of processes kind of tend to prune back the worst excesses of that. So you've got interaction, which is, you know, interacting with as many other nodes and other exclusive groups and different, and also beyond the system into other systems as well, through what they refer to in complexity as a semi-permeable membrane. So every system, like say a bioregion, it does have a kind of a, you know, it's not just this free flow of, you know, material and energy, etc., from other systems. It's, you know, it's a semi-permeable membrane. Things come through if they meet certain criteria. You know, it's almost like a smart contract. An edge is very generative and it brings a lot of different things through. and across into different parts of the system. However, at the same time, it also acts as a barrier, you know, to keep out things that don't belong. Yeah. So there's that principle of connection. You know, there's, you have to form as many different combinatorials as possible, you know, within the system in order to increase complexity. So it's different from growth. Growth is about growing the size of the system, which is our current economic system, but increase is a ceremonial thing. It's a ceremony that the land does anyway, with or without us. It's about increase, and you're increasing the relations and points of connection between different things. So if you've only got 1,000 things in a system, then you have 1 billion potential combinatorials of 3 within that. So you need to have that connection going on. And that interaction is about that constant flow and exchange of information, spirit, energy, materials, resources, all these things constantly flowing and cycling through the system. And if any single node is trying to accumulate and stockpile those things and create, you know, surpluses and scarcities and things like that, it blocks those flows of interaction. You know, so you need to have the goods of that system in a free flow of exchange and a sort of a sharing economy throughout that system. So, you know, nature does sharing economies. And if you're living within that, then your economy is a sharing economy as well. And the last one is that transformative one, the adaptation. And that's the thing. It's the trickiest one, because while you're allowing this information, knowledge, energy, spirit, nutrition, everything else, while you're allowing all these things, water, everything to flow through you, you also have to be allowing that to transform you. If you try to maintain yourself as this special thing that's just one thing and static, then yeah, everything else gets disrupted. So you have to be in a constant state of flux and transformation and allowing that system to do its work on you, you know, through those interactions. Yeah. And so that's those basic principles there. And I think if you're following those operating protocols, you know, within a sick system in the short term, then it's going to make you sick. That's the hard thing. I'm assuming you're Gen X, yeah.
Probably late Gen X.
I think that's the role of our generation, is to take one for the team. You know, the Gen X generation needs to put decent protocols in place for being that are going to damage us in the short term of our lifespans. And we're going to have to take one for the team. We're going to have to miss out on the capital and the goods and the rewards of this dying system as the boomers continue to squat on all those things. And we're going to have to be sick and have quite a decreased lifespan and all these things just to be behaving in the right way and making sure that there's going to be something left that's inheritable, you know, for the millennials and the Gen Zers, all these ones. Yeah, we're going to have to take one for the team and skip our inheritance. We're even going to have to skip on the privilege of leadership roles, because I think as soon as this current system falls, I think it would be a mistake for Gen Xers to step up into those leadership roles. I think we need to support and uplift millennials and Gen Z into positions of power. Basically, I strongly believe that if you don't have grandmothers, if you're so old that you don't have grandmothers, you shouldn't be in a leadership role. Your grannies, and that includes like your aunties and uncles sort of parents. So you have lots in our way, you have lots of grannies. Your grannies should have veto power over any decision you make as a leader. And that's part of the checks and balances of Aboriginal governance. If the grannies don't think it's a good idea, you can't do it.
Yes, and that leads into the kind of intergenerational equity concept of the three generations, and that what you do, you're going to have to deal with your grandparents, great-grandparents into the future and answer to that.
Yeah. See, your elders in our society, your elders are supposed to have a lot of authority but not much power. Power is supposed to be distributed, you know, throughout the community and rests with the young. You know, they're the ones who have to make the day-to-day decisions, but under the authority of elders who have that right of veto and who have the wisdom to guide you, you know, in the decisions you make and the things you enact on your environment and your community. And maybe we'll end up being worthy of having that kind of authority, you know, to guide the leadership of these young ones coming through one day, maybe. But we're going to have to get our act together, our generation, because we're pretty slack at the moment. We're not dealing with our dispossession and disinheritance very well. We're displaying a lot of dysfunctional tendencies.
I think as well, it's about being within that dysfunctional system and not kind of having that energy and enthusiasm of, say, a millennial who's, you know, they're out there loud and fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, but we've all been tricked in fighting around culture and identity, and that's where we're doing all of our fighting. But there aren't enough people fighting to change the actual condition of our lives. You know, that's been the big trick, because we can see changes, you know. We can make gay marriage happen, you know, and we can see change like that happening in the culture, and it makes us feel like we have agency. In the meantime, all of the structures that are killing everything and that are, you know, facilitating ever more rapidly this massive wealth transfer from the rest of the world to just a handful of boomers, you know, who are the custodians of the Anglosphere, we're actually facilitating that with a lot of our activism. So I guess as Gen Xers, we've seen that and we've seen the futility of that, and we kind of have lost hope. But I believe that that's our strength. I believe that hope is the biggest barrier to any meaningful action and change that there is. You know, hope is the lemon myrtle cake that they feed us. Let them eat hope. And every single one of us in our generation swallowed that one hook, line, and sinker at the turning point, which was when Obama was elected. You know, everybody got behind that weird neoliberal message of hope that we can make change. And we made some cultural tweaks and we all said the right things and did the right things and felt like we were in this beautiful new world. And it was just a simulation. And now we all feel the reality and we know we went the wrong way. And we know we had a moment of possibility where we could have changed things and we didn't. There was probably a chance. There isn't now. It pretty much just has to play out. And, you know, Gen X is just facing martyrdom, or we can continue to be minions of the boomers and enforce this system, or try and reboot it as capitalism 2.0, stakeholder capitalism. And it's just about sort of rebooting capitalism into something else that seems a lot fairer and that seems a lot greener, but basically allows them to keep all their shit and to keep extracting, because they're going to need to keep extracting under this current system. So Australia got out of the GFC not by economic stimulus packages. Australia dug its way out. They just increased ore production, which meant increasing predations on the indigenous community so that they could access more and more finite resources on Aboriginal land. And the plans are in place to do the same, to try and dig us out of this 10-year depression that we're commencing right now. So that's going to be ramped up again by a factor of 10. And we're going to see a lot more Aboriginal people in prison, a lot more communities shut down and restrictive. You go to a lot of remote Aboriginal communities and you'll see some very sort of Soviet stuff in place, you know, surveillance, but also institutions and of control in those places that have been set up. And they're branded with a sort of a liberal, you can do it, you know, opportunity hub kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Deadly choices, bro. Yeah, but no. we're all eating the myrtle cake.
We are. And, you know, coming out of this, what can we do?
Our hope lies in the death of hope. Anyone who's still clinging to it, let go of it. Hope is, you know, a longing for a future set of circumstances over which you have no control. You know, stop yearning for things to just get better on their own. They fucking won't. Stamp out the last dying embers of hope in your soul and step up, bruz. It's time to take back agency.
So can you talk to what we can do around agency?
Yeah, I think we need to build, you know, communities of practice and solid relationships to support each other getting through the short-term hurt of shifting to genuinely sustainable practices and communities and paradigms. You know, it will feel like shit. And we need to be able to support each other with that and develop cultural practices of connection and arts that bring those things out that we can do collaboratively and with joy. You know, and arts is important. We need to stop looking at art as a commodity that only a few geniuses are allowed to have access to, and that the top ones get paid millions and everybody else gets nothing. You know, art is something that needs to be reintegrated back into the life of every single person. It needs to be stuff that we're doing locally, collaboratively, and that every person is participating in. It needs to lose this idea of economic value. You know, art can have exchange value, you know, within communities and across communities, but that needs to be more evenly distributed. And the same as everything else, we need to approach food the same way we need to approach art. And there's no separation between those two things. So we need to get rid of these false divisions between disciplines that don't actually exist and between areas of interest and study and expertise that don't really exist, because these are just silos of knowledge that have been artificially separated to prop up the 80-year-old professor or dean that's sitting on top of that pile of knowledge in that little discipline. And we're all supposed to run around as gig economy casuals doing all the heavy lifting, doing oceans of admin around just recycling the same old ideas over and over again. You know, I tell you, if I have to read one more research paper about something like student perceptions of art therapy curriculum in a Masters of Public Health program, if I have to read one more of those freaking things, that tired, recycled stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I want to see people engaging with the systems and not just critiquing the systems and saying that they're unfair, because I'm sick of reading that too. We all know they're unfair. We know that the dice is loaded. We know the game is fixed. We know that, all right? Okay, just reference in the opening paragraph all the critiques of that. That's fine. But then we need to be engaging with how to take on these systems, how to make changes within it. You know, and I'm sick of the limp little programs that get rolled out that use a few buzzwords and get qualitative data from, you know, people who go, oh, it was amazing. It's just changed my life. No, I mean, that old auntie, you know, with the Marie Antoinette thing, let them eat lemon myrtle cake, she would have given lovely feedback back to them about that. Oh, yeah, I'm just feeling so much better in my kidneys. You know, she's self-reporting an improvement in her health. And I'm so happy to have been part of this program. She just really wanted to talk to somebody.
How did the dietitians react to your feedback on their program?
They didn't use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, they just wanted some Indigenous content. So they made it an Indigenous case study, and they were going to have a day where they all got together and had a lovely time cooking all those dishes. And I said, no, it needs to be more ready, steady, cook side. You need to give each of them $15 and say, you got to feed 6 people for a few days. And you need to find whatever you can that's seasonal and whatever is going to sustain life. So, you know, get out there. You might need to do a bit of urban foraging while you're
at
it.
We should make that a cooking show. Ready, Steady, Cook with Tyson.
Yeah.
I'd watch it.
I mean, there are, you know, Indigenous cooking shows, but it's cuisine. But, you know, you have to do that. Well, there's two horsemen universally, two horsemen of the apocalypse that indicate the decline of a civilization. Always towards the end of a civilization, there's inclusivity. You know, so you have like all the peoples that have been conquered by that empire, they start to give them higher roles, you know, token roles. So there's a lot of inclusion and diversity. But the other one, more importantly, is celebrity chefs. Every great empire in the ancient world and right up till the present, right at the point of its decline, it had celebrity chefs, every single one of them, you know, because everyone became obsessed with food. And, you know, in a lot of cases, the top chefs in an empire would be earning more money than the emperor himself, you know. So we're kind of intersectionally involved with that, because through inclusivity, well, we have to have a black cooking show, but we also have to have, you know, that has to be really high cuisine. So like every Indigenous celebrity chef is kind of one of the dark horsemen of the apocalypse. I always like to think that they're intensely aware of that and having a good laugh about it. But yeah, it would be fun to see a more kind of, I don't know if you're aware of that Ready Steady Cook show. Was that it? There was one in the UK and they'd just get 5 pounds.
Yeah.
I'd like to see an Aboriginal version of that. It's like, you know, you got your Keane's curry, Worcester sauce, black and gold label table salt, you know, those stock ingredients there. You have a bag of flour and a bag of rice, and now you've got like $10 to get your other stuff and let's see what you can do with it, bros. There was a really good comedy sketch in the White Blackacha. Not a lot of people have seen that one. It's really funny. And they were doing like a MasterChef parody, and they had like an Aboriginal contestant on there who did Devon three ways. And I was just like, you know, there were so many layers to that. It just that I nearly hurt myself. That was a bigger health risk to me than eating Devon itself.
That is spectacular. That's a good point, I think, to wrap up on. So thank you so much, Tyson. It's been really amazing to have you here.
No worries.
That brings us to the end of One Bite for this week. So thank you to our listeners. I'll put some more information in the show notes or over on the website at onebitepod.com. Tyson, do you want to plug any links?
Nah.
Just the book, Sand Talk. Get it.
Yeah, not even that. I'm not here for marketing. I'm here for the yarns, bro. I don't do branding, personal branding. I avoid it. That's the devil.
If this book can open up anybody else's mind, I think it's a really important piece of work in the world. So
yeah,
thank you.
Well, I direct people to like better thinkers than me. Like Christine Black is pretty bloody amazing. The Land is the Source of the Law is her book. And also for a more sort of practical engagement with the landscape and food and a custodial role for country, look at Victor Stephenson's Fire Country. Both really spectacular books, you know, at different levels of understanding around the law. And, you know, one on the practical side and one more on the cosmological side of things.
Awesome. Yeah. I will definitely link those in the notes as well.
Sweet.
If you do like the show, please subscribe, rate and review because it helps other people find us. See you next time. Bye.
See ya.